Right, yeah, so we'll look at then the mass shell constraints, then we'll go and quantize the theory and look at what the physical superstring spectrum looks like. Then we're going to go and look at a particular truncation of the superstring spectrum. We're going to truncate it even more, even beyond imposing the mass shell constraints on the Hilbert space. That's because we're going to need this truncation to accomplish what we originally set out to do. And then I'm going to work through a very detailed example. I'm going to look at the one-loop vacuum amplitude in superstring theory, and this will introduce a very important concept, an important symmetry known as modular invariance. Okay, so let's start with just some quick words of motivation. As I said, we're going to put fermions into the model now, and we're going to look at make a supersymmetric string or superstring. Why do we want to do that? Well, I'm going to use two guiding principles for why I want to do that. We saw yesterday that the bosonic string spectrum had an unphysical particle in it, the tachyon. So for us to have a physical theory, we need to somehow try to get rid of it. So that's going to be one motivation. The second reason is phenomenological. The bosonic string spectrum has only bosonic particles, so it has no fermions. And without fermions, string theory has no hope for phenomenological implications. There are certainly fermions in nature, so as far as nature is concerned, bosonic strings cannot be the whole story. Now, it turns out there are two ways to add supersymmetry in string theory. The first one, the original one, is called the RNS formulation, RNS for Raymond, Neveu, and Schwartz. It uses two-dimensional worldsheet supersymmetry. So we write down a two-dimensional field theory which has supersymmetry on the worldsheet. However, it requires this extra projection, the GSO projection. And what that'll eventually do is it'll give a theory that has space-time supersymmetry, so supersymmetry in the target space. It'll have a tachyon-free spectrum, and it'll also have this important symmetry called modular invariance, which I'll explain through this example at the end. The second way was developed about 10 years later by Green and Schwartz. This is a theory in which space-time supersymmetry is explicit from the onset. You write down an action which has target space supersymmetry. However, it's much more complicated than the RNS formulation, so I'm going to stick with the RNS formalism. And for many years, it was a big problem how to quantize the Green-Schwartz formalism in a fully covariant way. It's been recently understood how to do that, but for many years it was only understood how to quantize it in the light cone gauge. But it's much more complicated. The RNS superstring is nice because it really, its development follows the pattern that we did for the bosonic string. So I'll do that.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Are these just two different formulas, or are they two different theories? Are they two different formalisms, or are they two different theories?
They're two different formalisms. I mean, the spectrum in the end is the same. But they're very different, I stress. I mean, the action you start with is quite different. The Green-Schwartz formalism doesn't require, for instance, the GSO projection. So that's one argument for it. But okay, the RNS superstring. What is the RNS superstring? So we'll start like we did before. We take our string in d-dimensional space-time. It has some embedding functions, x mu, which are d-free massless scalar fields. And we wrote down a free massless scalar field theory for those embedding functions. Now let's add some fermions. We'll add d-fermions. We'll need d of them because we eventually want a theory that has supersymmetry, so we should have a match between the bosons and fermions. These will eventually be Majorana-Weyl spinners, as we'll see. They're massless. They'll carry a vector index, so they transform as d-dimensional vectors under the space-time Lorentz group. And then we go and we write down an action. Go write down a worldsheet action. And the action, again, I'm just going to write it in the conformal gauge. This is the supersymmetric extension of the Polyakov action. So the first term is just what we had in the previous two lectures, the usual kinetic term for the scalar fields. And now we just add a free massless kinetic term, a Dirac term, for these world sheet fermions. Okay? So this is just a Dirac term. The rows are two-dimensional Dirac matrices, so they satisfy this world sheet Dirac algebra. So remember, we're in two dimensions, so it's the Dirac algebra has a 2x2 representation. Our spinners have two components, and they're Majorana. We impose a Majorana condition on them, which just says that these components must be real. So let's take the kinetic term now, and we'll write it down in light cone coordinates again. Things are simpler to do in light cone coordinates, and we find that with the choice of Dirac matrices that I've made up here, the kinetic term can be written in this form. So I'm just reminding you again what these world sheet light cone coordinates look like. Now the equations of motion for the fermions, just as you expect, should give you the massless Dirac equation. And in these light cone coordinates, if you vary this action with respect to the size, you see you just get these equations. Very simple. Dirac equation in two dimensions written in these light cone coordinates is very simple. So we can identify the psi minus components as right-moving fermions because they don't depend on the plus light cone coordinate, and we can identify the psi pluses as the left movers because they don't depend on the other light cone coordinates. And I'm not writing down the equations of motion or anything for the x's. It's exactly as before, you see, because the x's and the psi's don't couple to each other, so everything you do for them is done independently. Okay, so we'll start with your first exercise of the morning. This is again another just straightforward gap filler. So take this action that I wrote down and show that it's supersymmetric. So show that it's invariant under these world sheet supersymmetry transformations. Okay, this is just n equals 1 supersymmetry in two dimensions. So just show that. So epsilon here is a constant infinitesimal anti-commuting spinner. So because when we look at the closed string, it'll turn out that this is a symmetry for both the left movers and right movers, so you say that the theory has a 1-1 supersymmetry. It has n equals 1 in both the left moving and right moving sectors. The second part of the exercise is to work out what the Noether current is associated with this supersymmetry. So just use the usual Noether procedure, work out what the conserved current is. You'll find that it's given by this formula. And then show that this Noether current satisfies this constraint. If you contract it with these Dirac matrices, it vanishes. And that's an identity. It's nothing funny. You just work it out from the form of J given here. So not all of the components of J are independent, and in fact, this gives you some additional constraints on the supersymmetric theory. So as we did with the bosonic string, we can now go and work out the modification to the energy momentum tensor, the world sheet energy momentum tensor, from the addition of these fermionic terms. So the first part of the energy momentum tensor looks like this. It's just what we worked out in the bosonic case. And then the contributions from the fermions are given by these terms. Okay? So remember, there are only two non-vanishing components of the energy momentum tensor. The cross components in light cone coordinates automatically vanish. And then from this constraint that you work out in exercise 1C down here, you find that these J's also give you a constraint. J plus or minus looks like this, and it's also gives us a constraint on the theory. So these are now our mass shell constraints at the classical level that we're going to impose on our theory at the quantum level eventually. Okay, so the bosonic case, we solved the equations of motion using mode expansions. We'll do that again. The mode expansions again for the x's are exactly as before, so I'm not going to write them down. For the fermion fields, again, you have to think about boundary conditions. You have to worry about boundary conditions. If you do the variation of the two-dimensional Dirac term carefully, you find that in addition to the Dirac equation, which is the bulk term, the thing you get from the bulk variation, you have to require that a certain boundary term vanish. And the boundary term looks like this. So we need this term to vanish at the two endpoints of the string, at sigma equals 0 and pi. And there are two ways to do that. You can show that there are essentially only, these are the only possibilities, that you demand that the left and right movers differ up to a possible sign at the two endpoints. Now, by redefining the plus component of the spinner if necessary, you could just arrange it automatically that at sigma equals 0, the two components coincide. So that's just a redefinition of the field. You can arrange it so that at one of the string endpoints, the two components are equal. But that still leaves two possibilities at the other endpoint. You can't do it automatically for both endpoints. You could do it for one, but then there's still a twofold ambiguity at the other endpoint. So there are two possible boundary conditions we can impose at sigma equals pi, and this will lead to two different types of two different sectors in the theory. So the first one, where we demand that they coincide at sigma equals pi, gives us what's called the Raman sector of the theory. And as we'll see very soon, in the Raman sector of the quantum theory, the states are space-time fermions. They look like fermions with respect to the target space. The other condition where we demand that they differ by a sign is called the Neville-Schwartz sector, or the NS sector for short. And we'll see that in the quantum theory, the states described by the NS sector are space-time bosons. So now we can go and write down mode decompositions of the Dirac equation. The mode decompositions are very simple here, right? Because so d plus psi minus equals 0 just tells you that psi minus is an arbitrary function of the minus light cone coordinate. And similarly, for the psi plus is an arbitrary function of the plus light cone coordinate. So it's a little bit simpler than what we had for the bosonic field. So you just go and write down. You write down basically a Fourier-type expansion in these light cone coordinates. Now the crucial thing is where this summation varies over. The sum over R will vary over either integers or half integers depending on what boundary condition you want at sigma equals pi. So if I'm in the Raman sector where I want a periodic type boundary condition at sigma equals pi, I let R run through integers. And conversely, if I want to flip the sign at sigma equals pi, I need R to run through half integers. Either choice is okay as far as the Dirac equation goes, but to satisfy the right boundary conditions, I need to restrict the range of the sum here accordingly. And the reality is a question? I'm sorry? What do you mean by a Dirichlet condition?
Well, I mean, what about del psi plus then, say, psi plus psi minus?
I'm not sure I follow.
Maybe it's
what?
Well, you're going to say del psi plus equal to 0 and del plus minus equal. So you're going to go straight on psi plus and psi minus to the end.
Let's see. Psi plus, delta psi plus.
Your two possibilities just...
No, but it works. No, but it works. It works. If psi plus is plus or minus psi minus, then delta psi plus is also that. I put it into here. There's a minus sign, and they cancel. Oh, that's. Oh, you're saying, why don't I let delta equal 0? Delta psi equals 0. Why don't I do that? Why don't I demand that delta psi be, just fix it at 0? This is actually, it should work for both, right?
I think the answer is that they're somehow equivalent, if I recall, but I don't remember.
Let me think about that. I don't know it. Well, this isn't closed string because I don't have the left and right movers. I'll do closed string in a minute. This works for open strings as well, or in one sector of the closed string. Okay, the closed string is more complicated because I can mix things up even more. We'll do that. This is open strings for sure. This is open strings. We're going to do closed strings in a minute. And this isn't spin structures. I haven't talked about. I'll talk about spin structures soon. This isn't spin structures. This is solving a boundary condition. Okay. This has really nothing to do with the fact that I've got fermions sitting here. This is just solving these boundary conditions. But let me think about your question. It's a good point. I don't remember. I don't know right off the top of my head why. Now we also have to impose a reality condition. We want these to be Majorana, remember, so the psi plus or minus have to be real, and that imposes this condition on these fermionic modes. An important thing to notice here, and keep in mind for later on, is that in the Raman sector, there's a zero mode. There's a constant piece, a piece which doesn't depend on these world sheet coordinates. That's important to remember later on, and it's only in the Raman sector that there's such a fermionic zero mode. Okay, now that's basically, implicitly I've done open strings there. For closed strings, what we do is we impose the Raman and Nevel-Schwartz boundary conditions on each component of the spinner separately. So that means that psi plus and psi minus now have these mode expansions, and we have two independent sets, psi and psi tilde, of modes. So on each component separately, you can impose Raman or Nevel-Schwartz boundary conditions. Okay, so the sum over R here is, again, depends on whether you're in the R or NS sector, individually on each component. So this now gives four distinct sectors in the closed string theory, right? Because there are four different possible pairings between the left and right moving modes. So I can pair both right and left moving sectors, I can impose both NS conditions or both R conditions. And we'll see, again, in the spectrum of the closed string theory, that gives us space-time bosons. Or I can put opposite things between the left and right movers. I can mix them up. I can put NS on the left, R on the right, or R on the left, NS on the right. And as we'll see, that will describe space-time fermions. So I'm just writing down, giving a little preamble of what you're going to see soon. Single-valued. I'm going to come back to that issue. So this is where the issue of spin structures comes in, right? Right? These are fermions. So we're going to talk about the single-valuedness issue later on. So now let's take the mass shell constraints. Let's go and write down the mode expansions of the energy momentum tensor and this Noether current that I had from supersymmetry. So for the minus minus components, again, I write down a mode expansion like this, exactly like I did for the bosonic string. And the LNs here, the first term is the familiar bosonic term that we had, but now there's a contribution from the fermions. And similarly, you can work out what the mode expansion is of J minus. I call the modes G, and the G's look like this. So the G's mix the bosonic and fermionic oscillators. And similarly, you can do this in the left moving sector by just putting tildes everywhere when you're working with the closed string. Okay? So again, I stress the sum over R here and down here depends in which sector, the R or NS sector, you are working in. Okay. Okay, so that's the basic setup. Now let's go and quantize the theory and look at what the spectrum of states looks like. So we're just doing exactly what the same routine we did for the bosonic string. So we start with an exercise to fill in the gaps. Show that canonical quantization gives you these anticommutators. Again, no big surprise because the fermionic field theory is a free field theory again, and these are just the free field commutators for a fermion field. So that's no big surprise, but just show that that happens when you do standard canonical quantization. Now, then the second part is to take these operators Ln and Gr, which appear in the mode expansions of the physical constraints. Remember, the Ln satisfied the Virasoro algebra, which is the first line here. Now, show that together with the Gs, they also close to an algebra, which is called the super Virasoro algebra, the n equals 1 supersymmetric extension of the Virasoro algebra. Note that now your central charge, the central charge C that appears here, when it was just the bosonic string, C was equal to D, the dimension of space-time, but now the fermions contribute to this central charge. They contribute this term D over 2. Okay, so there's this modification of the Virasoro algebra, of the conformal algebra of the theory. And then just show how the angular momentum has changed. Remember, we worked out in yesterday what the conserved angular momentum operator was for the bosonic string. It was this J alpha mu nu. And now the fermions also contribute a term K mu nu, which is given by this formula. So that's a straightforward exercise in field theory. Okay, so let's focus now on these canonical anticommutators that are given in this line. So again, these are just fermionic oscillators. There's a fermionic condition here. And so we build the fermionic part of the theory on a fermionic Fock space. A fermionic Fock space is much simpler than a bosonic Fock space. There are only two possible states. A vacuum, which is annihilated by the positive frequency fermionic oscillators, and then a new state that I call 1, which is created by these fermionic oscillators. Okay, so because of Fermi statistics, the fermionic Fock space has only two states. That's for a fixed mu. There are, of course, infinitely many copies of all of these. Now, so again, I identify the psi r's just like you usually do with a Fock space. The negative frequency modes are identified as raising operators. The positive frequency ones are identified as lowering operators. Now you go through the same thing I did yesterday, where I go and just start building up, start looking at the physical states, imposing the mass shell constraints. And while I'm not going to go through any of it, it's exactly the same type of logic, with slight modifications of the calculations. But you do that, and you'll find the following facts. You'll find that the superstring critical dimension is now d equals 10. So the bosonic string lived in 26 space-time dimensions. You'll find that that's lowered when you look at the superstring. It's lowered to d equals 10. The normal ordering intercept now depends on which sector of the theory you're in. It's either zero, it's zero in the Raman sector, and it's a half in the Neville-Schwartz sector. Okay, so there's this normal ordering intercept in there again. And these numbers are easy to work out. You see the alphas and the psis in the Raman sector is where you have the same boundary condition. You demand that the spinners are equal at sigma equals pi. Both the alphas and psis will contribute the same term to the normal ordering when you use zeta function regularization. They'll contribute the same term but with opposite sign. So the normal ordering terms will cancel. You'll get zero. In the other sector, the NS sector, because you sum over half-integer mode levels, the fermions contribute one-half of the normal ordering that the alphas do, and again with the opposite sign, so you get A is a half in the Neville-Schwartz sector. So that's how these numbers come about. Okay, physical state conditions now, you go write those down. Again, it's familiar from what we had yesterday. We've got the Hamiltonian constraint, L naught minus the normal ordering on a physical state vanishes. The positive frequency LNs annihilate a physical state. And now I have these extra modes G floating around, so I also demand that physical states are annihilated by the positive frequency modes of the Gs. So it's exactly what I did yesterday. The only additional thing is the constraint on Gs and the form of these operators. So as we did yesterday, the first constraint gives us a mass shell relation. It gives us the mass formula. So the mass squared is equal to this. This is completely analogous to what I had yesterday. Note now that the value of A depends on which sector I'm in. It's either a half or zero depending on which sector I'm working in. And N is the fermionic modification of the number operator. So the first term is the usual fermionic number operator. The second term is the contribution from the fermions. Note that N can be half integer now. N could be half integer because if I'm working in the NS sector, then this sum is over positive half integers. So these terms can be half integral. Okay, so that's completely analogous to what we did yesterday. I haven't gone through the details, but that's what you get. So let's look at what this tells us now. We'll start again with open strings because they're simpler. Start with open strings and let's start with the NS sector. Let's look at the NS sector. So the NS sector, in this formula, you put A equal to 1/2. Okay? Put A equal to 1/2, and let's look at the smallest value of N that we can get. Well, the smallest value of N is, again, N equals 0. That's the vacuum state. The vacuum state has N equals 0. And again, there's a unique state which satisfies that. It's the one which is killed by all the alpha positive frequency alpha oscillators and the positive frequency fermion oscillators. And it also carries a momentum with respect to the zero mode of the alphas, so it carries center of mass momentum K. Right? Remember, there, in the NS sector, there is no fermionic zero mode. Okay, so now you put N equals 0 into that mass formula with A equals 1/2, and you find again that the mass squared is negative, and the state is tachyonic. So we've still got this annoying tachyon in the spectrum. We haven't gotten rid of it yet, but we will soon. What we'll have to do is further, we've truncated the Hilbert space already by imposing the mass shell constraints, but we're going to truncate it even further very shortly, and that'll get rid of the tachyon. So let's not worry about that right now. Let's now look at the first excited levels. What are the first excited levels? Well, the first excited level still keeps the number operator for the bosons equal to 0, but now, remember, I'm summing over half integers in this. So the next value of N is actually 1/2. So when I make this quantity equal to 1, this sum equal to 1, and I pull out a 1/2 in front. Okay? And I do that by just acting with the lowest fermionic oscillator on this vacuum state here. Okay? So that gives me N equals 1/2, and A is 1/2. So m squared is equal to 0. So this is a massless state. It has a vector index again, and with respect to the transverse rotation group of the space, remember we're in d space-time dimensions now, so the transverse rotation group is now SO8. So this is a massless state. It's a vector under this SO8 group, and it describes the 8 physical states, physical polarizations, of a massless photon field. Okay? So again, the first excited level in the NS sector gives us the photon. Now, because of their transformation properties under this SO8, you can show that all of the states built in the NS sector are space-time bosons. They're bosonic with respect to their transformation under this SO8 group. Okay? So this is the statement that the NS sector produces bosons with respect to the space-time theory.
How do you know that they're bosons?
Because of their transformation under SO8.
Yeah,
and you'll see...
Spin,
well, I use the spin statistics connection. I use the spin statistics theorem. No, it's fermionic on the world sheet. Okay, but I'm talking about its space-time transformation. I mean, this transforms as a fermion on the world sheet, but with respect to the target space, it's a boson. Well, no, I'm taking the spin statistics theorem as given here. Okay? There's a, for me, a fermion or a boson is telling me something about its transformation under the Lorentz group. Okay, now the Raman sector. Let's look at the Raman sector. What happens in the Raman sector? Well, the Raman sector, we have a zero normal ordering intercept. The zero normal ordering intercept, and remember there are zero modes here. The Raman sector has zero modes, and you go and use the canonical commutation relations and look at what is the algebra satisfied by the zero modes. The zero modes satisfy this algebra, which is just the nine plus one dimensional Dirac algebra. It's a Dirac algebra of the space-time. Now that has a finite dimensional representation, and the psi naughts up to some constant are up to some normalization factor are just Dirac matrices. They're Dirac matrices in the target space theory. So there are Dirac matrices, and then the claim is then that all states in the Raman sector should be 10-dimensional spinners. They should be 10-dimensional spinners because they should furnish a representation of the 10-dimensional Dirac algebra that these fermionic zero modes satisfy. So they transform in a spinner representation because they have to form a representation of this, and therefore all Raman sector states are space-time fermions. Again, with respect to their transformation properties. Now the other, now in this sector, let's look at what this fermionic constraint gives us. This fermionic constraint gives us a wave equation for the states in the fermionic sector. So let's look at what that is. Well, the lowest mode, remember there's zero modes here, so I'm focusing on the zero modes right now. The lowest mode of this equation looks like this. This is just, again, the mass shell constraint. So I annihilate the physical state with G naught, and that gives me an equation that we call the Dirac-Raman equation. Dirac-Raman. Why is it called that? Well, this is what G0 looks like. Okay, so there's a zero mode part, and then there's a contribution from non-zero oscillators. Now the alpha naught, psi naught term, what does this look like? Remember, alpha naught is basically the center of mass momentum. So in position space, it's like a derivative, a space-time derivative. And psi naught is a gamma matrix, as I just showed you. So this combination, alpha naught dot psi naught, is just the Dirac operator in space-time. It's just the space-time Dirac operator. And then there's also some extra stuff from the mode. So that's why we call this operator G0 is called a Dirac-Raman operator. And indeed, the square of G0 squared gives us the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian is just like the momentum squared. So it's like the square of the Dirac operator. So this is very much like the Dirac equation. In fact, we can turn it into a Dirac equation. We'll define the Raman sector fermionic ground state as the state which satisfies annihilated by these modes, the positive frequency bosonic and fermionic modes. Then because of that condition, you look up here, this means that when this operator hits this state, because all of the positive frequency terms from either the alphas or psis kills it, this sum goes away. And the Dirac-Ramond equation looks like this now. And the Dirac-Ramond equation now is just the ordinary Dirac equation. So the fermionic ground state in the Ramond sector is a massless Dirac spinner in 10 space-time dimensions, because it satisfies the massless Dirac equation. So it's a massless Dirac spinner, and in 10 dimensions I can split this. If it's just a Dirac spinner, it can have either chirality. So I can split this up into chiral ground states now in a Majorana-Val representation. So there are two irreducible representations now of this with respect to which this spinner decomposes, and I'll denote those by A and A bar. And these irreducible representations are the states which carry a definite space-time chirality. And I'll come back to the issue of space-time chirality in a moment. Okay, so that's the Ramond sector. And that's the open string done with. What about closed strings? Well, closed strings, we know how to do that from the bosonic case. We take two copies of our open string and just glue them together. What you find if you go through the exercise that we did yesterday now, that when you do that, the closed string sector gives us not these massless matter type fields, but it gives us supergravity fields. Okay, so we saw in the bosonic case yesterday that the closed string sector gave us gravitational fields. Now we get supergravity fields. I've summarized what happens in this table. I don't want to go through all the details. In the first column, I list which sector we're in. Remember, there are four possible sectors now, depending on the types of gluings that you do at sigma equals pi. The second column tells us what is the boson-fermion parity of the states in that sector. So just like with the open string, these states will have certain transformation properties under SO8. Those are listed here. The third column tells you the SO8 representation. So I'm telling you, classifying the SO8 representations, and that tells us what the massless states are. Okay? The group theory will tell us what the massless degrees of freedom look like. So the NS, for example, what we do is we construct it by taking the tensor product of two vector representations of SO8. You can work out how those decompose into irreducible representations. Again, there is a symmetric, an antisymmetric, and a singlet representation. And we get exactly the same gravitational fields that we saw yesterday, namely the space-time metric, the B field, and the dilaton. So the NS sector is always just formally the same as in the bosonic string. It gives you exactly the same information that you had in the bosonic string. The mixed sectors, NSR and RNS, they're fermionic states. That's because you construct them by taking basically an alpha oscillator and combining it with a psi oscillator, so bosonic and fermionic oscillator. So for the massless states, you take the tensor product of a vector and the spinner representation of this SO8 group. That decomposes now into two types of spinner representations, the 8 and the 56. And again, the massless states that are described by these representations are the gravitino and the dilatino. And similarly, you go do this in the other sector, you get analogs of those fields as well. The last row of this table I'm being vague with because it's much more complicated. This is the Ramond-Ramond sector. These are bosons. They come from taking the product of two spinners. You take two spinners. You're gluing up combinations of the psi oscillators. So I've just vaguely written that with respect to the SO8 representation, this gives us what are called P-forms. So they give us antisymmetric, what I call P-representations. And the massless states are things called Ramond-Ramond fields. I'm being vague there. The first thing we're going to do in tomorrow's lecture is go and analyze in detail what the Ramond-Ramond sector looks like. So I'm just going to leave that as a little bit vague right now, and we'll tackle that tomorrow. So there's the closed, there's the superstring spectrum.
Which of the ASM56S is the Cavitina and the Dilatina?
Let's see. I think the Dilatino would be the 8S. Okay, it's the Dilatino is the super partner of phis, which is spin zero. So the Dilatino has spin a half, so it should be the 8S. Okay, now the GSO projection. The main reason we want to do this is to get rid of that tachyon. And it turns out that there is a consistent way to further truncate the Hilbert space of physical states of the superstring. And this is something called the GSO projection. And this is absolutely necessary for the consistency of the interacting theory as a physical theory. How do we define the GSO projection? Well, in the Neville-Schwartz sector, I define it in words, I just define it by keeping all states which have an odd number of fermionic oscillator excitations. So I keep only those states that I built with an odd number of fermions. Okay? For instance, the photon state I built with one fermionic oscillator, so I will keep that. We remove the states with an even number, so that's in words how we do it. How do we do it analytically? Well, what we do is we take each physical state and we replace it by a projection operator acting on that state. So we just take the Hilbert space and act on it with a projection operator. The projection operator is defined by this formula. So F here is the fermion number operator. Okay, it just gives us how many fermions are in my state. So if F is odd, this projection operator is non-vanishing, and indeed I keep states that have an odd number of psis acting on it. But if F is even, you see that this vanishes, so I kill everything that has an odd number of fermions in it. And this minus 1 to the F operator anti-commutes with my spinners. So what does this mean? If I have an odd number of fermions, remember what this modification of the number operator looked like. It's now going to be half integral, so only half integer values of n are allowed. So the spectrum of physical masses, if you read off from the mass formula, looks like this. It starts at 0. Remember, A is a half. The normal ordering intercept is a half here, so it starts at 0, goes to 1 over alpha prime, and so on. Integer multiples of 1 over alpha prime. So there's no, the ground state is now just the photon. It's just the photon. The ground state is massless, and there's no state with a negative mass squared. Okay? The tachyon was the state that had no psi, zero psi oscillator. So I've removed that now, and bang, that's what I wanted to do. So that's in the NS sector. In the Raman sector, how do we define it? We define it by exactly the same formula. So PGSO, the GSO projection operator, looks exactly like this in the Raman sector, but I modify my definition of minus 1 to the F now. I take the same object, the fermion minus 1 to the fermion number operator, but now I multiply it by the 10-dimensional chirality operator. So I take the product of all my gamma matrices and form gamma 11. And that satisfies these relations here. There's a sign choice you can put here, and you ask, does the sign have any physical consequences? I'm going to discuss this in more detail tomorrow. The answer is, in the open string sector, the sign has no physical consequences. It's just a matter of what you want to choose. And it's just a matter of choice of what type of chirality you want your spinners to satisfy, right? Because this operator projects onto spinners, space-time spinners, of a definite chirality. That's exactly a given space-time chirality is a plus or minus 1 eigenvalue of the operator gamma 11. So that's exactly what that operator does. And in the open string sector, it's just a matter of choice, which chirality you want. You want gamma 11 equals plus 1 or minus 1. In the closed string sector, it's a little more complicated. This does have physical consequences, and we'll see a bit more. We'll see how that works in tomorrow's lecture. Okay, so that's in the Riemann sector. Now, let's ask the question, does the theory possess space-time supersymmetry? The answer is yes, and the answer is yes exactly because of what I do with the GSO projection in the Riemann sector. So I'm not going to prove it. This is not a proof. This is a consistency check just to see if at least the counting of bosons and fermions works out. So let's check the massless spectrum. Let's just check how many degrees of freedom I have in the massless sectors. So in the ground state of the NS sector, remember this is a boson, it's the photon state. The states look like this. They have some polarization vector again, zeta. It's a massless vector. The mass shell constraints eliminate 2 degrees of freedom. So it has d minus 2, d is 10, which is 8 physical polarizations. Okay. Now what about the Riemann sector? Remember, this is a fermion, the ground state Riemann fermion. Okay. Now I multiply it by the GSO projection. Okay. What does the GSO projection do? Well, I start with a Dirac spinner, just an arbitrary spinner, and that in d dimensions has 2 to the d over 2 components. Now, I apply the Dirac equation to this, and this gives me a Majorana type condition. Now, I'm hitting this with PGSO, so I'm projecting now onto a particular Weyl representation, something with a definite chirality. So the Majorana and Weyl conditions each reduce this number by a factor of 2. So that's where the 1/4 comes from. So 1/4 times 2 to the d over 2 with d equals 10 is also 8. So the number of bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom coincide. So indeed, there are an equal number of bosons and fermions in the two sectors. So this is a good consistency check that our theory might have space-time supersymmetry. And indeed, you can show various things. You can show that this ground state forms the vector multiplet of the d equals 10, the 10-dimensional n equals 1 supersymmetry algebra. There are various other things you can show. I've shown this only at the level of the massless states, but you can show that the entire superstring theory possesses space-time supersymmetry. This is, of course, most easily done in the Green-Schwarz formalism that I mentioned earlier, where you start with space-time supersymmetry from the onset, and then you go and show that the entire spectrum of interacting states also has space-time supersymmetry. But indeed, the message here is that the GSO projection has done two things for us. It's eliminated the unphysical particles from the spectrum of the string, and it's also given us a theory that's supersymmetric with respect to the target space. Okay, so the last thing I want to do today is to work out an explicit example. This is just to give an example of everything we've really done so far, even in the bosonic case. And also to illustrate one more remarkable property of the GSO projection. It does one other thing for us, and it does it in a very non-trivial way. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a one-loop calculation in superstring theory. We're going to go and compute the one-loop vacuum amplitude. Okay? This is the simplest loop calculation I can do in superstring theory. So I'll go through that in some detail. We start with an exercise again. This is again just a simple exercise with a harmonic oscillator, essentially. If you have a collection of bosonic oscillators, show that for any complex number Q, I should have written here Q not equal to 1, I guess, that there's a trace formula like this.
Okay.
And this is a fairly straightforward exercise. It's just a matter of tabulating states of this number operator. So just tabulating carefully states in the Hilbert space and working out what the trace is. So there's this formula. And then there's an analogous formula for fermionic oscillators, which looks like this. So it's a different formula because of Fermi statistics. Okay? We're going to use those momentarily. So now let's look at the one-loop closed-string vacuum amplitude. What is the one-loop closed-string vacuum amplitude? Well, I've got a closed string. It's just a loop. And it propagates in time. And the vacuum amplitude, a vacuum-to-vacuum amplitude, I want the closed string to propagate in time and return back to its original position. Okay? So it moves around, and what does it do? Well, it sweeps out a donut. Or more mathematically, a torus, a two-dimensional torus. So the thing I want to evaluate is topologically a surface which is a torus. So what does the Polyakov path integral do? I discussed this schematically yesterday. What it does is, after you do the right gauge fixing and everything, it sums only over conformally inequivalent tori. Tori which cannot be related to each other by a conformal transformation on the world sheet. So we need to understand that a bit, and I'll explain the mathematics behind that a bit right now. So how do we specify a torus? Well, we can specify a torus, first of all, by a flat metric. A torus is flat. We have another degree of freedom. It's called its complex structure. And this is parametrized by a complex number called tau, which has positive definite imaginary part. Now tau, what does tau do? I'll show you a picture. Let me do that now, actually. Okay. Tau, I can represent a torus in the following way. I can use a parallelogram representation. So I take the complex plane and I draw a parallelogram in it. And what I do is I identify opposite sides of that parallelogram. So this side and this side are identified. This side and this side are identified. And that clearly gives me this donut-shaped thing. And the complex number tau is what specifies the tilt of the parallelogram, right? So this is the number, the vector tau in the complex plane. So if tau is 1, this is just a square torus, but I have this option of tilting it. So that's what tau does for me. Alternatively, this parallelogram representation just means that if you denote the complex coordinates in this plane by W, it means that I restrict to, I take the complex plane and I restrict it down to this region by using these identifications. I identify W with W plus 2 pi n and with 2 pi m tau for any set of integers. So I just impose this periodicity constraint, and that just restricts everything down to this parallelogram. So this is just another way of representing what a two-dimensional torus looks like. And tau is a degree of freedom on the torus that cannot be changed by any conformal transformation. Right? A conformal transformation just blows up areas. It doesn't change angles. It blows up areas. It rescales things. And there's no conformal transformation which is going to change the tilt of this torus. Okay, so we should focus on taus. The taus now, that tells us that the taus are specifying the conformally inequivalent tori, but you have to be careful because not every complex number of positive definite imaginary part gives you an inequivalent torus. Lots of different taus give you the same torus. An obvious one is if you look at tau and tau plus 1. Okay? If I look at the torus with tau plus 1, what does that do? Well, that just shifts my parallelogram over to here. Just shifts it along the real axis. But it doesn't change its orientation. It's just the same torus. So tau and tau plus 1 give us the same torus. Right? So we should identify the torus with complex parameter tau with the torus with complex parameter tau plus 1. Now, that's only part of the story. There's actually a larger a larger symmetry. It turns out that all the equivalent tori can be reached from a given complex number tau by what are called modular transformations. So the modular transformations are generated by two operations on the taus. The first one I call T, and it's just this shift I mentioned up here where tau goes to tau plus 1. And the second I call S. It's the operation that inverts the complex parameter tau. And you have to put a minus sign in here to make sure that the inverted thing has positive definite imaginary part. Now these two operations satisfy some relations. They satisfy these identities. S squared is ST cubed is the identity. And in fact, they generate a group which is called the modular group in this context, and that's just the group SL2Z. And that's just the group of discrete Mobius or linear fractional transformations of these parameters. So a general modular transformation looks like this. It's just a linear fractional transformation. It's parametrized by an integer valued 2x2 matrix in SL2Z. So that just means these numbers are all integers, and this matrix has a unit determinant. So that's what this condition means. And this gives us, this tells us what all the inequivalent taus are. So all the equivalent taus are related by an SL2Z transformation of this form. So what we need, so now we know how to restrict restrict the sum over tau in the Polyakov path integral. We should restrict it to what's called a fundamental modular domain. What's a fundamental modular domain? Well, it's a domain, it's a region of the complex tau plane which is invariant under these modular transformations, and for which any point outside of that domain can be mapped into it by one of these SL2Z transformations. So I've shown a convenient choice of modular domain here. It's not the only choice. There are lots of choices of fundamental domains. This is a convenient one to use. The region shaded R is my modular domain, and you can easily show that if any point is lying outside of this domain, you can map it into there by using one of these SL2Z transformations. So to summarize, the Polyakov path integral, when I sum over all of the inequivalent tori, it'll give me an integral which is restricted to a fundamental region of the complex plane that looks like that. Right, so now let's go and evaluate the path integral. So what does this look like? I mean, what is the partition function? The partition function naively is just taking, you take the trace of e to the minus time times my Hamiltonian. That's the path, that's the partition function by definition. So you're tempted to just go and stick in the Hamiltonian operator here and take the trace. But you have to be careful what happens. Imagine that you have a string propagating in time. Okay, so in the parallelogram representation, my string is moving along this axis here. Now, when it moves through an entire cycle on the torus and comes up to here, it's not only propagated in the time direction, but it's also shifted over a bit, right? Because when I have a tilt on the torus, not only do I induce a shift along the imaginary axis, but I also have to shift over along the real axis. So propagation on the torus induces both a time and a spatial translation with respect to the world sheet. So that's what I've written here. If we move for a time psi 0 along the imaginary axis in time, then it also shifts to a right by this amount. And we know how to affect the time translation. We affect the time translation using the Hamiltonian operator, which is given by this formula. And the spatial translation, we know how to do that. We affect it with the world sheet momentum operator. So the path integral should be properly defined as follows. It's the trace of the time for propagation, 2 pi tau 2, times the Hamiltonian, but then you have to remember the spatial translation. So I need to stick in this momentum operator as well. Okay. So using these formulas now for H and P, you find that this can be written in a simple form which looks like this, where Q is defined to be this complex number, e to the 2 pi I tau. All right. So that's my path integral, and what does this number look like? Well, what is the trace, first of all? What do I mean by a trace? Well, I mean a bunch of things. I mean, first of all, the integral, the sum over all tau. So it's the integral over the fundamental region with respect to this complex parameter tau. Then it's an integral over the continuum of bosonic zero modes. So it's an integral over all these zero mode momenta k, the physical one, so that's why there's a 24 sitting up there. So this is the contribution from the zero modes to the Hamiltonian and the momentum. And then there's a trace over all the oscillator states. So that's where the n's come in. These are the bosonic number operators now. So these are all the oscillatory contributions. But now you've worked out this exercise where you've evaluated a trace similar to this. And in this context, when you put in all the degrees of freedom, you find that this trace just becomes this product here. You get this infinite product. The K integration is easy to do. It's just a Gaussian integral. And you're left with this formula. Now these things combine into something, a quantity, which is known as the Dedekind function. It's defined by this formula. And the important feature of the Dedekind function is it has a non-trivial transformation property under modular transformations. And your exercise now is to show that the integrand sitting here of the partition function is a modular invariant. Show that it's invariant under these SL2Z transformations of tau. So you use this result to do that. And this is really, really an important result that this thing is modular invariant, right? Because it tells us that the Polyakov path integral is correctly summing over all of the inequivalent tori. And it's counting each of them once and only once. So that's absolutely crucial for the consistency of what I've been saying so far. That this thing be a modular invariant and it correctly counts all of the inequivalent tori. Okay, what I want to do now is let's see how to generalize that to fermions. Let's do the superstring. Now, yeah. I'm sorry, I can't hear. Do I need to sum over K? The Kähler moduli. Well, but the Kähler moduli come when I put in like a B field, right? Well, I mean, the torus isn't specified by its Kähler moduli. It's specified by its modular parameter. The area of the torus, but the area of the torus, the area of that parallelogram can be written in terms of tau. Right? Okay, let's do the superstring now. Now the crucial thing about when you put fermions into this is that fermions on the torus are specified by a choice of what's called a spin structure. And a spin structure just tells you what type of boundary condition the fermion has as you go around a given cycle of the torus. Okay? So I've drawn it schematically here. It depends on how they behave as you send the size to psi plus 2 pi. So the box I've written here is denoting symbolically the result of evaluating the Polyakov path integral with a given boundary condition on the fermions as you go along the cycles of the torus. So when I have a plus in either side of this box, it means I've evaluated the path integral using the periodic boundary conditions around both cycles. If I have a minus in a given place, it means I put an antiperiodic boundary condition. I allow the fermions to change sign. So this is something I'm allowed to do with fermions, and it's called a spin structure. So there are four possible spin structures on the torus, depending on how I evaluate the path integral with a given boundary condition. Now you have to use a bit of guidance now from what you know about quantum statistical mechanics, that if I have a fermionic theory when I do the path integral formulation, I should do the path integral by giving the fermions antiperiodic boundary conditions. This is the only way to reproduce the standard Fermi-Dirac distribution in the path integral approach. So what you need to do to appropriately change the psi zero boundary condition is to insert factors of this operator minus 1 to the f in the traces which will define the partition function. That'll flip the boundary condition because of this anti-commutation property that I wrote down before. So depending on how I want to put in these boundary conditions, I need to insert appropriate factors of minus 1 to the f. Now this will also, of course, depend on which sector of the theory I'm in, right? Whether I'm in the Raimond or the Neville-Schwartz sector. So I've written down what the traces look like here. The subscript R means that I should look at states only from the Raimond sector. The subscript NS means that I should look at only states from the Neville-Schwartz sector. And you can stare at this for a bit and convince yourself that these sectors with the appropriate insertion of minus 1 to the f were necessary gives you the right boundary conditions on the fermions. I've just written H here. I haven't written the contribution from P. Now the observation you need to make is that a given spin structure is not invariant under modular transformations. It changes when you apply these SL2Z transformations. For instance, if I start with a minus minus spin structure like this and change tau to tau plus 1, what does that do? Well, that takes the axis here and it flips it down like that. Now there's a minus boundary condition sitting down here, so that's going to flip the sign of the boundary condition sitting up there when I do this transformation. So SL2Z transformations in general mix the spin structures, and the transformation properties are given right down here. Okay, so I'm coming to my last overhead now. We're just about done. Now note one thing here. Note that there is one spin structure that's invariant, and that's the plus plus spin structure. That's completely invariant. In fact, the reason it's invariant is because it's just zero. Okay, you can show that this thing vanishes. And why does it vanish? Remember, the Raimond sector has a fermionic zero mode. It has a fermionic zero mode, but the Hamiltonian is independent of that zero mode. So when you do the path integral, you've got an integral over a Grassmann number and something which doesn't depend on that Grassmann number, and you all know that that's zero. So this thing vanishes. Up to constants, there's a unique modular invariant combination of spin structures. It looks like this, with the signs placed as I've shown it. And now you can go using these formulas here and write down what is a modular invariant partition function. So I'm putting this in by hand, right? I'm looking at these transformation rules and finding some combination that's a modular invariant. I go and write it down like this. This is what the answer is here, using those formulas. I now use the fact that this thing vanishes to just add zero to this, and I find that the R and S partition function can be written in this neat form as a trace over the entire superstring sector, NS and R included, with the insertion of the GSO projection. So this is just the GSO projection operator sitting here. So this gives a beautiful interpretation of the GSO projection. Geometrically, all it does is it restricts the partition function to a sum over modular invariant spin structures. So the GSO projection gives us an additional bonus. It ensures that the superstring theory is modular invariant. And as I stressed before, that's a very important fact. Well, what is this thing equal to? The answer actually isn't very interesting. It's interesting how you get to it, though. Work out what these are using that exercise I gave before for the fermionic oscillators. You've got some traces to do there, but you can evaluate them in terms of infinite products here. And then you stick them into this sum and see what you get. The answer is zero. The answer is zero. It's a non-trivial zero, and there's a remarkable identity due to Jacobi, which was discovered in 1829. It's called the Jacobi abstruse identity, and it looks like this. I look like I'm pulling things out of my hat here, but this is a fact. This is the Jacobi abstruse identity. And this tells us that the sum of these three things vanishes. And this is absolutely crucial, again, for supersymmetry. This is a consistency check of supersymmetry because it means that bosons and fermions contribute equally to the path integral and with opposite signs. So they cancel each other out and you get zero. Remember, it's a vacuum amplitude, so the vacuum energy that you get is zero. That's what you should have in a supersymmetric theory. And it's really cute the way it works. I mean, Jacobi referred to this as a very obscure formula, which it is. It's a very obscure formula, but this formula is what's responsible for space-time supersymmetry at one loop order in superstring theory. Okay, I'm finished.
Any questions?
You just check it. Go check that it's modular invariant.
But you just said that it's zero.
Well, okay, it's zero, yeah. But, I mean, you know, it's zero, but that's, you know, appreciate the logic behind it. I mean, I found a modular invariant combination first, not worrying about what it actually equals. And yeah, I get zero. It's modular. But you could show that, I mean, with these rules, you can show that that's up to some constant. That's the only modular invariant combination you can find. So, beyond one loop. Oh, this is a complicated thing. And the best way to show that is using the Green-Schwarz formalism again. Two-loop calculations in superstring theory are notoriously difficult. In fact, it was only about, I guess, a couple of years ago that it was fully resolved how to do higher loop orders. I mean, there's all kinds of... One loop is quite simple. When you go to higher loops, it's a nightmare. So it has been proven using the Green-Schwarz formalism.
So thank you again.